How do you live your life like tomorrow matters? Perhaps you're already growing food, consuming less, connecting with your community. Perhaps you're already thinking hard, keen to see the world a little slower, greener, healthier. But where to begin? Here on the Future Setting Podcast, we dig deep into the hearts and minds of blissfully normal people doing bloody amazing things, unearthing their moments of contradiction, their hopes and fears for the future, and what galvanises them to action, in the name of inspiring all of us to do a little more in shaping a better future today. I'm Jade, and this is Future Setting. So, I'm sitting in my car, fieldside, watching my boys run around with their breath hanging in the air at soccer training. It's a twice-weekly privilege that I've taken to stacking with all the other non-9-to-5 things that need to be fitted into life. Needless to say, I don't share these moments on the socials, although in the name of keeping it real, perhaps I should. I'm a little wearisome tonight following a huge weekend at the Off-Grid Living Festival. Were you there too in Little Chilton in northeast Victoria? If so, I imagine that your cup, your heart, mind, and your future vision for life will be as full as mine. If you weren't there, stick it in your calendar for this time next year because it's a potent elixir for all the things future setters seek and love. While me talking and having a stand at this place of barefoot, future-oriented humans makes sense, perhaps you'll be surprised to learn that the weekend also included a scramble in the muddy paddock car park into formal wear so that we could join our twin boys at their debutante ball. Yes, I did say that they went to their deb ball on Saturday, and it truly was the antithesis of what the daylight hours of the weekend represented, with pomp and preening, fake tan, fake eyelashes, fake nails, excess on every table and on every human, and a distinctive lack of reverence to set our next generation up with. Honestly, everything about it made me question our society. And while it definitely wouldn't have been my chosen Saturday hangout, our boys did indeed look dapper. They'd learned all the dances over weeks and weeks of training, and they tapped their toes in all the right places, and one of them even gave the official thank you speech. So while I wasn't fond of the scene and everything that it stands for, I definitely was proud of my boys. The next day, when I was back at Off-Grid with bare feet on the earth, I soothed my soul with a conversation with Robin from Pip Magazine, who reassured me that while ideology is aspirational, we actually need to be kind to ourselves as we navigate this complex transition and as we build new rituals and create new rhythms and essentially create a new story for ourselves. And what she was really saying was what today's guest refers to as finding contentedness with being various shades of green at different times in our lives for different reasons. So while I like to think of myself as an ambassador for the dark green team, sometimes you just have to be comfortable as a proud mid-green or even on Saturday night, a very faint pastel green. To explain this shading system far better, I'm going to hand you over to today's guest, Kate Luckins. About a year ago, I received an email with an invitation to speak at Melbourne Sustainability Festival. The email was direct and it was clear without superfluous words, so I said yes. The woman inviting me, who was also hosting the panel discussion, turned out to be the wonderful with words, Kate Luckins. Luckins as in lucky, not Lukens. We've just clarified that. Who I have to say we have with us today in all of her shades of green, and we'll chat about these shades of green in just a sec. Kate is a doctor of sustainable living, no less, and has recently written the book Live More with Less, which is a nifty and brightly coloured little gem that holds your hand while you act on climate change in a way that makes sense for you right here and right now. Also, if you cast your mind back to the early 2000s, you might also recall the clothes swapping phenomenon that swept the globe. Well, Kate has been credited with bringing this to Australia. Unbeknownst to me at the time, I was actually one of her disciples because not long after I'd read about these amazing clothes swaps that were happening everywhere, but specifically in Melbourne at the time, I opened an upcycled homewares and clothing store called The Clothesline, and I even tapped into Kate's button idea, which was the terms of trade. She hasn't always been this incredible eco-warrior, though. Like most teenagers, she rallied against her folks' eco-warrior stance on existence, only to whip back around to adopt her very own take on living this way. So folks out there dealing with difficult teenagers, take heart. But in her words, she's doing this with a very solid understanding that we are living in imperfect times, and so we need to make the best of what we can do. Kate, it is lovely to have you here.
Oh, I'm so excited. Thanks, Jade.
No worries. So you've written a book, and we were just before we pressed record, actually I had pressed record, but I won't share this with everybody else. We were just talking about the fact that you write a book as an excuse to then start conversations, and you were just prattling off the six events that you've got this coming week with the Sustainability Festival in Melbourne. Is this why you wrote a book, to start conversations?
Absolutely, because I think, you know, when you write a book, you've got to do it for a variety of reasons. I think particularly if you're producing a product out there and all that, particularly from a sustainability perspective, you really think, you know, there's going to be people that read the book. There's going to be people that share the book with a friend. They're going to be people that have those conversations between each other or just distill a little bit to a friend. There's going to be opportunities for me to dig into some of the ideas I've been kind of hermiting away and mulling over in my own head. And that means you can take the idea and build it, challenge it, make it better, make it more relevant to everyone. So absolutely, the book is a good excuse for a chat.
And it's filled to the brim, as you just said, with ideas that have been sitting inside for a long time, but now you've finally got the chance to share them. The best part about it, and I don't just want to talk about the book, but just for a second, the best part about it is the fact that literally any human could pick this up, no matter where they were living in, whatever way they were existing, and apply it to their own way of being accessibly. You know, there's nothing there that says you need to completely rewrite the way you exist. So you've made it user-friendly for anyone in any place.
Yeah, I absolutely probably spent as much time thinking about what people might need in this kind of book as I did writing it. Absolutely, because, I mean, to be honest, you could read it in half a day, or you could have it by and read bites of it, fall asleep, wake up, take another tiny bite. It's very user-friendly. And that's because I'm conscious that a lot of the people I'm hoping to reach are actually those concerned people who are also incredibly busy. They mean well, they're concerned about climate change, but, you know, they're passionate about it in one moment, and then they're, you know, trying to get the shoes on the kids or get out the door wearing pants or, you know, packing a lunchbox the next. Like, it's really hard to reach not only a busy audience, because that is, yeah, sure, we're all busy. We can still find time, arguably, but we're also very crisis fatigued. Group of people, particularly in Melbourne where I'm from, where, you know, a lot of us have been, you know, life has challenged us in many different ways, and we've been forced to ask many hard questions. And the idea of this looming climate Armageddon is a lot for people, and it's really understandable that a lot of people shut down. So I wanted to crack open the door and have a life friendly conversation that's empathetic about this, and actually address those barriers of why we do stay. I shouldn't say barriers, I should say challenges, because they're actually really easy to overcome if you have a think about it. But there's various good reasons why some of us stay on the sidelines or fall back there, because that's the thing. Sometimes we're on and we can make great new habits, and sometimes we're in survival mode.
Yeah, and sometimes we take two steps forward and one step back.
Yes, or vice versa.
That's got to be okay too. Yeah, that's completely got to be okay. When I introduced you a second ago, I talked about your various shades of green, and I think this is something that we can probably all relate to. But let's understand your various shades, because you've been all of the shades, and we're all really familiar with greenwashing. But let's get an understanding of what you actually mean by that.
The shades of green. Well, I think It's probably clearest if I reflect on my own shades, because I know that quite well. And so for me, I grew up with a greeny dad. We were collecting cans together. I would have been rather doing other things, of course, but we were collecting cans, and I got to play with the first solar car. I think it was a bit low for taste buds, but I had all this early induction, and I had this, you know, complete trailblazing eco warrior of a dad. Yes, as you mentioned in the intro, didn't really have a bar of that as a teenager. And then I didn't really have much of a bar of anything, my mum would probably say.
Oh,
Like,
God, that gives me
teenager.
serious hope. This is very real in our household right now. We've got a massive chasm, massive chasm. So this gives me hope.
Yes, I have a son who's now a teenager who is very much like me, and I am full of empathy for my beautiful mum who dealt with me.
Oh.
But anyway, that's I'm sure a conversation for another day. So the shades of green. Then by the time I got to uni, I had this epiphany. I was actually studying to design high-end attractive furniture, probably for exceptionally wealthy people. And I read a couple of key books, stopped in my tracks, and realized I'm going to create the landfill of tomorrow. I'm not using my design skills to solve problems. I'm creating crap. Like, sure, it might be attractive, but I have a complete discomfort, and I was absolutely, I can't put something new out into the world. This is not what I want to do. So I kept studying and studying and studying. And I guess the long and the short of it was the clothing exchange was an experiment that really kickstarted a conversation and showed me the power of sustainable living and people coming together. But obviously, at this time, I wore only vintage dresses. I attended to my veggie patch. I had no car. For a long time. And what else? Oh, just imagine the eco-righteousness. Just think the
So
difference.
ideology was oozing out of the orifices in
Oh,
all
I had
directions.
nothing better to do than sit around mulling over how I could solve the problems of the world with like-minded souls in like little Melbourne cafes. It was awesome. But also, when I had my first son, there was quite a awakening, I guess. All of a sudden, a complete priority shift from what was most sustainable to what was most convenient. And as I say, whatever it is, everyone has times in their life, I think, where they go into this survival mode. So, it's interesting the role of being a parent in that way, because you're on one hand, you've got to keep the big picture in mind, but your world does become a bit smaller in that those early days of chaotic
Oh,
mum.
yeah, does it ever? Yeah.
I
It's a
was
feed at a
all right,
feed at a time is what my mum used to say. Just a feed at a time, and if you can get through each feed, you can just beeline to the next one. She's so right.
yeah, but also it really awakened the consumer in me, because I was really concerned. I had to get a car, so we got a secondhand car. I had to, I was really concerned about the most, safe car seat and, the pram, and then, oh, I need a cup holder for the pram. And, there's just such a flow-on effect. And this is the interesting thing with life. We make one decision and then we actually necessitate a whole lot of extra consumption around that. So it wasn't this, distinct. I was green and I wasn't. But I definitely, like I tried with biodegradable and reusable nappies, but they weren't great options at that time, and I gave up. Like, there were little battles fought, and some of them definitely lost along the way. But I have to say that I led with that more with convenience and care and just getting through the day, and those sort of primary values driving my decisions more than my ecological values for quite some years. It wasn't a short time.
And now where are you at? What shade of green are you in?
Definitely unapologetically medium green. And I realize, just before I had my son, I finished my PhD in sustainable living, and I could have taken all those wonderful stories and ideas I had at that time and written a book. I don't think that would have been that worthwhile to put out in the world. What I think is really needed right now is this idea that we can be medium green, and that can be, I do really deep green. I'm really committed to my garden. I'm really committed to sustainable fashion and shrinking my fashion footprint. Quite often, when I interviewed both sustainability leaders for this book, but also just your everyday eco heroes, I call them, who are giving it a try, you can't necessarily do all the things at once, but you can find
No.
your way and deepen that
Yeah,
practice
of course.
of green. And in other capacities, you might have some constraints, whether that's time, finances, etc., that mean you can just take a lighter shade there. But we end up with this medium life-friendly shade of green. And every time I do get a bout of eco guilt, I just remind myself I'm medium and I feel a bit better. And that actually keeps my momentum high.
And momentum, high momentum and joy in the process actually allows you to maintain it.
Yes, it's actually a little bit about that old personal sustainability as much as it is the ecological and social sustainability, I think.
On a day-to-day basis now, because your kids are a little bit bigger and you've finished your degree and you've written a book and you now have an identity that's wrapped around this, what is it that gives you that physiological quickening that makes you really feel like you're doing exactly what you should be doing?
I feel it's when I fall into a good flow of things, and it's almost, you know, some of the habits I have are always, you know, like there's always things I'm trialing that are new and awkward and I have to be really conscious of them and stick a note on a fridge or do something to remind myself of the new habit. And then, you know, I'm very happy on at the end of the week where you grab all the weird bits of fruit and veg and, you know, the squishy apples that have done a few trips to school via the lunchbox and don't look, you know, your kids won't scowl at them, won't take them. You know, soft carrots, all those guys, you round them up and then you do this own little, your own little like version of a MasterChef mystery box and you think, how creative can I be with these leftovers? Because I love cooking and particularly love eating. This is a pleasure zone. And then that rolls into, you know, then you go, oh, I'm going to take those off cuts and make a little smug stock stash that I'll find later in the freezer when I've got something to create a stock with and build that up. And then you kind of go, oh, and what will I do with those leftovers? I'll compost those and then, oh, I'll grab the worm tea while I'm out there and pop that on the lettuce. And you're just kind of flowing through it. And then you realize, you step back, you put everything, you know, out for the week and you go, oh, that was only an hour and a half and I've got my week sorted. And don't I feel impressed with myself?
I feel virtuous. Look what I can achieve in such a short amount of time in my own backyard.
Yeah. And look, you can do the 10-minute version of that. I mean, you know, if you learn how to edit your fridge, that's a very satisfying. It could be a 5 or 10-minute job. Like not everything.
Let's talk about that. What's a fridge edit? Tell me about that.
So the fridge edit is super fun. And I never realized how much people could enjoy taking a before and after photo of their fridge and sharing it with us. There's a lot of selfies that people delight in. And that's because it is a gratifying thing. So the Stockholm Environment Institute basically alerted me. There's various great reports, but that was the one that kind of tipped me off that there are a few key things we could do to reduce our food waste, which is a massive problem. Mm-hmm. It's as if we're throwing one in every 5 bags of shopping straight in the bin. That's mm-hmm. our food waste average.
Yeah, I saw that on War on Waste with Craig Rucastle and remember mm-hmm. thinking, wow, that's definitely not us in our household because we grow our own food, so I don't waste it at all. But I imagine that is most people's reality.
It is, and it's not because we're waste-making villains that cackle as we turn melons. We are not trying to do this. This is incidental. No. Little bits here and there, the corner of the toasty that gets left behind. It's the, you know, wibbly bits of veg that's an Anna Matilda, the urban nana term. I love it. Wibbly bits.
Wibbly bits.
We don't know what she means when she says that. It's the wibbly bits. It's the that we don't yet know what to do with, even though they could serve a purpose. It's little bits that add up every day. Mm-hmm. It's often losing track of what's in the fridge. So organizing your fridge so you don't overbuy was one of the things that, you know, the Stockholm Environmental Institute report recommended. And I think Oz Harvest have done quite a lot of work on this too. Mm-hmm. And they have their use it up tape. And this, whether you buy the tape and support that awesome organization or whether you just have a section in your fridge, I think is what we suggest in the book. You just have a section which communicates not just to you but to all your household what needs to be used first, because you just need to catch it in time.
Yes, before it starts to go particularly wibbly and slimy and slurpy at the back of the fridge.
Whoa. There's wibbly and there's ooh, like ecosystem. I should say, I say we because very importantly, the fridge edit is not just about saving waste for the planet. It's actually about boosting your nourishment and simplifying mealtime. And that's why so my fridge looked like it was stuffed ready for Armageddon. I was an overbuyer, absolutely. And everything you read in the book is based on my experience, overbuying condiments and getting sucked into every foodie fad, being aspirational about the healthy food and the time I'm going to have to prepare it that week and ending up buying pizza in China.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't see the you know, decomposing vegetables in the fridge. But I collaborated with Georgia Harding from Well Nourished because she is A, a naturopath, mm-hmm. and B, as the fridge of people's dreams. So, again, everything I've put in the book is actually tested on a very unreliable subject, which is me. I figure if it can work on me. And we have tested this one on thousands of people. It can work very well for others.
Mm-hmm. So can we just get a very quick summary of what a Fridge of Dreams looks like?
Fridge of Dreams is, well, you create a system of order. Is based on using stuff that you already own. You're not buying fancy eco packages and bibs and bobs. You use what you own. The produce that you have is packaged or contained in a way, avoiding packaging if possible and where possible, in a way that extends the life of the food. So George is a bit of a whiz with the salad spinner. She can get 2 weeks out of her lettuce leaves.
Can she? That is a talent. Yep.
The talent. For me, I have, you know, I try and dematerialize and reduce packaging as much as possible with refillable items and stuff like that. But ultimately, the key thing is to buy what you need and to really get your food to flow throughout the week. You just need to pay a little bit more attention to a pre-planning audit of your fridge. So you have a good look at what you've got to say if you're going to the shop and buying 3 maple syrups and ending up forgetting the butter. Because you also don't want to be storing your fridge with multiples of things that you won't actually need for months, because that's a waste of energy and a waste of your fridge real estate, and it will block your view from those leftovers from Tuesday night that you
So the fridge audit, and the reason I dived a bit deeper on that is because really the fridge audit is just a beautiful analogy for everything else that we can do in our life. We could do exactly the same thing with our wardrobe, the same thing with our third drawer down, the same thing with whatever we've got in the gardening shed. You know, the same thing with stationery. I know there's people out there who love to consume stationery. It's a thing. I don't know if it's a diagnosable thing, but it's a thing. And so really all of these things can be applied, and all of these things are extrapolated out in the book beautifully. Can I jump into, so this whole series at the moment is in relation to my next book called Huddle, and it's about really taking this way of being and collectivizing the efforts. And so throughout the book, you've spoken to a huge number of people that I guess is amplifying the collective voice of different ideas that can be delivered. But I want to dive a little bit deeper into that and unpack where you think the story or the culture that we sit in needs to be changed and how we might do that.
How we might change the culture. I think really what needs to happen is we need to fill this gap between our concerns, which might, you know, arise when we watch that David Attenborough documentary where we see the lone polar bear floating on that ice cap. He's got iceberg. He's on the he or she is on the iceberg and has nowhere to go. Our heart bleeds, and in that moment we're like, nothing is more important than this safe future for us and that polar bear. And then you get up and you unpack your dishwasher and you move on with the micro details of your everyday life. And I think we are really missing some stuff in between. So what I was quite passionate about this whole time, and the reason I did interview people and take a more storytelling approach, is we've got a lot of what. We know we could list 10 top tips off the top of our head. I constantly screenshot things on my phone with all the wonderful eco people I follow, and I rarely follow through. So our issue isn't what to do. We've got lots of ideas about what to do. Our challenge and how I think we move the collective is by talking about how, with a greater sense of honesty, which means like going, what is it like in the weeds? How do we make decisions in the murky swamp of sustainable living? How do we help each other through this? And what should our self-expectation be? Because we do have in our movement that we've both been a part of for a long time, there's a lot of fear around climate change, which can be paralyzing.
Yep.
There's a lot of confusion. And there's a lot of, I don't know, just this kind of, well, on the other hand, we can also have, I guess, a lot of idealism, and we think, that person's doing X, that'd be nice. But we don't know how to break it down and get there.
Hashtag sustainability goals. You know, people often put that on things I put on Instagram, and I think, oh, no, no. And I often go back to them if that's what they've put there to say. The real side of the story is this: what you've hashtagged then and set as your aspirational benchmark is something that's taken me 15 years to build rhythm and ritual and, you know, collective knowledge around. So use it as a benchmark, sure, but be very realistic in knowing that it's a long, slow journey of two steps back, two steps forward. Too forward, too back.
Well, you take, you know, there's always within every like ambitious goal. So say, you know, I'd love to not need to own a car or not feel I need to own a car, and I'd like to go back to my walking, cycling, PT days. But what else can I do? Like, what are the shades of green within that principle of how I get myself around? Well, I can share rides with friends. I can plan my route well so I don't overdrive. I can not idle at school pickup, waiting in the car if I have to pick up. I can, you know, obviously there's various choices about the car, and this is one I do address in the book, is I don't have an electric vehicle, even though my kids are like, get a Tesla, Mum. I'm like, no, I'm going to keep driving the same old station wagon, Mum-mobile that's covered in spiderwebs because I don't drive it often enough to avoid the spiderwebs. And I'm just going to keep that trucking along because I don't drive enough to justify the embodied energy of a vehicle. So it's interesting, you know, within any big picture decision or any, you might have an ambitious goal and then there's all these little shades of green. And sometimes you can just do, you know, the palest, and sometimes you can hit the middle, and sometimes you can sell the car.
I love the way you're addressing that, because people are often really quick to throw the hypocrisy line at you. And I think the reality is, unless we're sitting in a cave being hermits on our own, which actually doesn't serve a purpose either because we are collective beings, we actually need to sort of swim in the murky mud that we're in, and we need to acknowledge that we're in transition. And even if you're not quite at that absolute transformative sort of horizon three thinking, you could just be at 1.1, which is mostly business as usual, but a little bit better.
I think there's particular, you know, times in your life, like the fresh new year is a great time. We're often filled, you know, if we have a bit of a break, catch our breaths, if we're lucky, we have the momentum to try something new. When you've got something else major going on in your life, and as we said, you're just trying to make sure there's milk. That's not the time. I mean, it can be tricky to maintain the sustainable practices you've got, let alone add anything new in. So there was, when I actually did my PhD, I travelled to chat to people around Australia who were living more with less effectively. They were the sustainable living trailblazers in all these different kind of, with all different lifestyles. And I just remember this one young guy in Sydney who was like, oh, I'm vegetarian now, but I'm on my path to becoming vegan, and I'm just going to keep making decisions while being kind to myself. And I've never forgotten that conversation. And you know, I think a lot of us who really care can be quite hard on ourselves, and just remind, you know, treat yourself like you would a friend who's doing their best.
Compassion and empathy.
It's part of this sustainable living picture, absolutely.
And did you find that that was a pretty solid piece of the puzzle when you were doing your doctorate?
Yes. And the other thing that I found was quite interesting, actually, and this has probably shaped what I think is worth sharing with the world in terms of conversations and the book, et cetera. And that is that it wasn't the people who were in government who felt the most powerful and influential. And it definitely wasn't the person who gets up on their soapbox and says, you should do this and you should do Y. It was the people who I'm now referring to as the everyday eco heroes, who just start doing something. Like they start some composting, they start, I don't know, growing a tomato, they start, it's something really simple, and then they love it, and then they enthuse about it.
Or
they just, you know, that attracts some, you know, curiosity from a friend. And over time, these people who don't consider themselves radical trailblazers or leaders or anything, but they've just become the unofficial authorities on sustainable living in their communities, in their homes, in their family, in their workplace. You know, in the book, I give the example of Danielle, and she just talked about her delicious vegan bolognese recipe that her whole family ate, which was quite a revelation. And sure enough, four people went home that night with that recipe in hand, eager to try a highly delicious new recipe. So leading by example, just simply walking the walk. On one hand, It's not something we haven't heard of before, but it is really critical in this spreading these sustainable ideas far and wide and embracing them with as much enthusiasm as possible.
Mm. Are you still comfortable with the word sustainable? I know that this is really contentious and people say sustainable is for yesterday and we need to be deeply regenerating because sustainable is status quo. Tell me what your thoughts on that are.
I can tell you that I'm old enough to have seen a lot of rebranding in terminology throughout the ecological movement, like, you know, global warming to climate change. There's good reasons for that. What else have we had? I don't know. There's always a new word. Everyone loves circularity, regenerative. You know, sometimes we shift the terminology because we're diagnosing the situation and it needs to shift. And then other times I think it's just different. It's just a sort of a rebrand. I think that the word sustainable has always been really tricky. And I can remember giving a lecture to my RMIT students that I felt, again, it was like a pivotal moment where I fell upon an idea that I realised was quite important. And I said the sustainability movement needs a theme song. We needed, at that time, we had people who ranted and raved like this. I'm waving my hands around and it was all, you know, let's scare the hell out of everybody and let's be really extreme and let's, and I was like, we need to apply, you know, the people who do the branding for the high-end cars and all the, you know, the fancy consumer stuff. We need the messaging to change because sustainable as a term can mean anything to anyone. It's far too context reliant. And I swear I went to conferences when no one knew what it meant back in the day. Mm-hmm. And we have to, you know, we have some working definitions of what that means about meeting, you know, the needs of today so people can meet those needs tomorrow. And we have various definitions, but I think you found a really great way through the future steadying definition. But the living more with less was me saying, this has been far too complicated, but also we need to capture
back the noise.
Yeah, we need something that we can print on a T-shirt or we can have in our shoulders while we're at the shops to remind us. We need something we can hold in our minds. So live more with less really speaks to living more, which means more connection, more cooperation, more freedom, and more of what we value, and less overconsumption, waste, planetary destruction, and eco-guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so much in that, isn't there? It's the simplicity that sits on the other side of complexity. And we're in the muddy complex too often with so many messages being shoved down our throat and the noise of, you know, the consumptive media telling us that endless growth is where we need to be headed. Are you doing this alone or do you feel like you've got a network built around you? And if you have built that network, what was the language and what were the tools that you used to do that?
Yes. On one hand, for someone who's a really excitable extrovert, I spend way too much time working and writing on my own. So I actually really flock to other people and I will join, you know, wonderful groups with like-minded people who are doing similar things. And I'll definitely like, so I guess there's me reaching out and then the welcoming in. I like to, if I'm doing this for myself and I'm finding value in it, then I'm a big sharer. I mean, the clothing exchange is just one example. Mm-hmm. I like it. And I see value in welcoming in. And definitely the stories from the sustainable lifestyle community, when I threw out questions to them, I love these overwhelming responses that I got, people detailing all these wonderful stories within their lives and the great things they were doing. And there's definitely examples of those beautiful stories, whether it's like a seasonal food preparation ritual that would be your cup of tea, Jade, or whether it was, you know, someone grappling with their teenage kids and trying to get them on board. Or
sadly, that's currently my cup of tea too.
So I think that the real value comes when, yeah, the ideas are shared and explored and pushed further into practice.
In whatever way works for you in your community. And sometimes that's online. There's a huge amount of stuff that's online. Where would you send people if they were just starting out on this?
Just starting out. What kind of resources? It depends what category you're looking towards. I think, you know, the fashion revolution stuff is great for getting your head around some sustainable and ethical fashion stuff. I think that Sustainable Table has always been one of my go-to favourite sites, particularly when I need to know, you know, which fish is more sustainable.
Eating guides, yeah.
That's one of my go-tos. I think we're lucky that there are more and more leaders in the space that we can look to for inspiration.
Mm.
But definitely the work I'm doing is for, and what I'm putting out there and the conversations I'm trying to have are for those people who are either on the sustainability bandwagon or falling off and need a little bit of help getting on and reestablishing that momentum, or brand new. Like, definitely,
yeah.
I think I've seen a lot of people over the 20 years we've had the clothing exchange going. And again, I say we because there's Kirsten in Sydney and there's all these people over the years that have kept that community and that wonderful swap community going. And I think, yeah, I think it's the coming together in person and bouncing off each other and reminding each other that we're in it together. I think that's also part of the equation.
Well, there's a lot of magic in that, and sustenance cup and cup filling in that, isn't there, the coming together. I remember talking in the very first season of Future Sitting with Erin Rhodes, the Rogue Ginger, and she said it sort of doesn't really matter how you come to this way of thinking. There are many, many highways that take us to a similar place, but actually it's really about identifying your on-ramp. And for some people, that's putting their hand in the dirt and growing food. For some people, that's joining a community garden and or a community clothes swap. For some people, that's undertaking a waste challenge or an energy audit. Doesn't really matter what your on-ramp is, but that's really the first step. And I have often reflected on that, because I think the first step can often be the scariest and the hardest to navigate, because you essentially, you're saying to everything that you know in the way that you are, I don't want to be this anymore, I want something different, and I'm just going to leave you behind a bit while I explore a different pathway.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to find your own path in and start where your interests lie, and don't worry about whether what you do is big or perfect. I think that, yeah, what Erin says is absolutely true. I couldn't agree more with that.
Mm. Yeah, it's beautiful advice. And that is beautiful advice too. It doesn't have to be perfect. So the imperfect, I want to go back to that, because that word appears quite a lot in your book about the fact that we can just embrace the imperfect. We are humans and we are complex and we are a bit imperfect. So let's talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think it's an important counter message, because our consumerist society focuses on often priming us to feel insecure and inadequate in some way, so we compensate by buying something.
Mm.
Like, we don't often buy, and we might buy in celebration, maybe some champagne or something, but we often buy because we are compensating for something or competing or participating in a way where, you know, maybe we are obliged to buy something. Maybe it's a ritual to buy something. But if you actually pick apart your days, you just realize how much of modern interaction relies on this act of buying or spending something. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's really integrated. And sometimes we're sitting on the couch scrolling, just thinking we're catching up on what are our friends doing. And before too long, we've loaded up our shopping cart and we're buying an extra thing we don't need to get free.
Yes.
It is seamless. So I think our contentment, if we can find that, is the antidote to this consumerism. I think it really, really is an important piece of the puzzle. So feeling good about ourselves, feeling comfortable, feeling at ease, feeling satisfied, what we kind of disrupt that kind of wanting, that constant insatiable wanting that we have. And it's not again, you know, this is complicated because this is a societal cultural thing. This is not.
Yeah, this is society wide. It's systemic.
And this is the tricky thing. Society and culture has so many different messages, particularly for women, so many messages about this kind of perfection that we should be seeking, or this betterment in so many aspects of life, whether that's being fitter, healthier, more successful, wealthier, et cetera.
Yes.
We're supposed to be doing all these incredible things. But we could do with a message of you know, enjoying that imperfection. And when we see those messages in some of the women I reference in the book, whether, you know, you have Celeste Barber, you know, absolutely humanizing the unrealistic beauty standards in the work that she puts out there. You know, we need to advocate for imperfection and relax things back down to a position where we can all feel at ease and we can all relate, and that pace of consumption isn't so elevated and intense.
Mm.
I really think. It's bigger than the book. It's bigger than the book.
It's definitely a cultural unpacking that's required. And I think as an individual who is then trying to seek that place of contentment, that can require a huge amount of unpacking and inner work and sort of tapping into our own bodily wisdoms, and having the time and headspace to do that can be overwhelming and daunting. And so, again, as you say, let's just bring it back up to what we can achieve and how we can navigate this in an imperfect way. What I have asked this since the beginning of this whole pod, and sometimes I forget to ask, but actually it really gives beautiful insight. In your mind, what does success look like?
I think it's kind of cultivating a sense of, yeah, there's just enough. Like I have an ease and I'm, you know, going through the day with, you know, relative flow, and, you know, it's not a perfect picture. In fact, it's perfectly imperfect. Like, you know, sure, we make a bit of a mess here or there with the dinner, but, you know, I enjoy cooking, you know, making a pesto pasta with some basil that's grown well in the garden with my son, and enjoying that and having that time together. I enjoy, you know, taking him on his first vintage shopping expedition and like finding the absolute thing that he thought he couldn't get from new from the shops, and we've got our hot little hands on it. I feel like, you know, you have sort of these perfect moments. You know, sometimes when I'm having a very imperfect moment, I feel completely, you know, my climate distress or some other distress peaks. Just, you know, that walk at the beach that calms your nervous system right down and makes you feel good. But ultimately, I don't think I'm happier than when I'm having one of these great chats about really, honestly, you know, because this is, sure, we're looking at this through a sustainability lens, but we're talking about making people feel better. That's really like where we're giving a bit of relief. And that's probably the most important thing, is we're not just talking about saving the planet. We're talking about a social movement here. We're talking about feeling like we can actually enhance and upgrade the way we live by questioning some of the things where we've been yet to, and embracing what we value. So the most important thing is, like, I've tried to open up this smorgasbord of sustainable living, and I've got this little umbrella which has, you know, future steading, minimalism, has all the different ideologies and I guess the pathways in. And I just think it's really important that we have that personal reflection and think, well, what do I actually want? What's the sustainable lifestyle I want? And you're just using it as
and can maintain.
And can maintain at a pace that's life compatible, rather than the one I think I should have. Because we've got a lot of wacky ideas out there about what a sustainable, there's some really narrowing ideas about what a sustainable lifestyle looks like. And I think we needed to do a bit of work on challenging that as well.
Where would you start on challenging that?
I think it's important to just share lots of stories, lots of examples. I think that contrasting, you know, the stories of people living in different circumstances, different time availability, different family structures, different levels of commitment, even different shades of green. I think that the more that we can actually get inspired by these people who are leading by example, within our communities, I think that really helps move us forward, because it answers that question of how do I do this, and how much should I expect myself to do, and what's okay and what can I do?
Yeah, I know. I often look at the, you know, I might put the rubbish bin out and there's a lot of rubbish in there, and I think, how am I still doing that? I am totally wedded to future steading, yet my rubbish bin is still full. And then you think, well, actually the last few weeks I've been away with work a bit in a plane, generating carbon miles, you know, like all of these things that we are doing our best not to do, but sometimes you can't avoid them. And so I wasn't around to make home-cooked food for the kids, and so they were buying things for their lunches. And, you know, you sort of justify it, and you can get really overwhelmed really easily by where you're falling short rather than the celebration of the bits that you are doing. There's that beautiful saying, we don't need 100 people doing it perfectly, we need a million people doing it imperfectly. And I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for the ritualized collectivism that comes with that.
Absolutely. And we have to be realistic in what we're asking in terms of what we can change, because us Aussies are good in a crisis. We can actually create, we've shown we can adapt to a pandemic. We've shown we can rally help people through bushfires. Like we're actually very capable to adapt, but there's also, you know, on one hand, we've got this urgency to create a lot of change, but on the other, a lot of the people who have the most power to create the change are the people who are actually the most stressed and stretched. It's the caregivers and whatnot who control a lot of the consumption and make a lot of the key decisions and shape the views of the children and the people within the community. So they're the most powerful, but also the most stretched. So how do you reconcile that? And look, this is an ongoing conversation.
Of course.
Perfectly in a bow by any means.
No. Well, when you do, let us know because we'll amplify that story tenfold. You've got kiddos and you said at the top of the show, you know, they're definitely pushing back on my way of thinking and being. How are you navigating that?
Very imperfectly. So I think in the toy edit chapter, which is actually, I mean, on one hand, it's a toy edit. You know, it's for someone who's sick of stepping on those sharp corners of Lego brick and it's feeling over, you know, so that's the gateway in. But really it's a talk about how you can foster greater connection and veer away from that consumerism in kids because they are born to buy. They don't know anything other than this rapidly consumerist world that we live in. And they, you know, YouTube, thank you. You've made my kid speak fluently at 8. Like he's like, what's this? And he's singing a song about a Rolex and it's like, what is it? All these absurd branded expensive things. And where have you got your barometer on what is relevant to you and even accessible to you? And, you know, I talk about how, you know, you do this dance with your kids because my son, you know, when he was in prep, it was the era that fidget spinners were cool. And I was like, no, you're not.
Boy.
That is a fad. And yeah. I said, ugly in my position until I saw him at school and realized he was the only kid without one sitting there looking decidedly miserable. And of course the heartstrings get pulled, you're off to the shops immediately to rectify the situation. And then 2 weeks later he says to me, Mom, fidget spinners are so last week, like, you know, that's so not in fashion. Like he's gorgeously savvy little fella. But now occasionally I do get my values parroted back to me, but it's not consistent, and particularly around the fashion choices. My kids have, it's hard to find clothes for tween boys. It's hard
to find
ethical clothes. It's really hard to find secondhand clothes because they're often worn to
trash them.
So the main thing I can do is encourage them to buy less and value it well at this stage and seed that idea. And then we have discussions around things and I say, how about this brand? You know, if you can think about the sweatshop aspect, if you think about this. But then in the book, I do talk about the transformative power of my first pair of LA Gear sneakers and how I'd been the off-brand sneaker girl and how magical that moment is. So whenever I'm talking to my son, I'm going between my current values and empathizing with what I remember it was like to be there. And I end up somewhere in between. Sometimes I end up closer to my end of the conversation and sometimes I, you know, given with some parameters.
And this is your beautiful mid-grain.
This is. And I also, the thing is, if there were more options available, and there are some really good brands, there are some options, but if, you know, sometimes we butt up against the system and limited options and constraints. And that's also where you have to be kind to yourself and go, well, I've done what I can and now I'm reaching a limit and I'm just going to accept that and move on to the next decision because we are trying to buy less and live more in a society that is trying to push us to buy and waste more. That's the way it's structurally designed. So we have to be conscious that we're operating in that kind of world. And that also means that this perfection idea is incredibly hard to ascertain.
Yeah, so down with perfection and let's celebrate imperfection. If you were to give one piece of guidance or direction to our listeners before you head off for how they may live more with less, what would it be?
I think the most important thing is to find your door in or to find your pathway back. So start with something that interests you and captures your enthusiasm and you'll get this wonderful spillover of things around it and your energy and enthusiasm for that will be infectious and you just can't underestimate the ripple effects of that in your community. I think that's what we need to move the collective, as you said before.
Yeah, start to normalize that way of being. Yeah, just in our language. I spoke to someone yesterday. Actually, I was at a work meeting and someone said, you look completely different. I said, that's because my hair's up because I have been swimming in the dam all summer. Or I haven't had showers. I've just swum in the dam since Christmas. And everyone in the room said, that's disgusting. I said, it's not really. I'm having showers every day. It's just that it's in cold dam water. It's not sort of generating a heated, you know, I'm not requiring any of this energy to actually make it happen because the dam is fed from the local creek. But that really, really just could not have been normalized in that particular group setting. And I thought, wow, okay, I'm a long way from where other people's normal sits. So we just need to rewrite what normal looks like.
And I bet you enjoyed those beautiful dam swims.
Oh, my God, that has revolutionized my whole summer. I've walked out the door, taken all my clothes off at the end of every day of work, whether it be in the barn, in the farm gate, or behind the computer for my sustainable table work. And I've walked stark bare all the way down through the berries and filled my belly, done some yoga on the little deck down there and then jumped in. It's been a heaven.
That's one hell of a lifestyle upgrade. I think that we all need that joy.
So if we are all shades of green and all of them are A-okay, which shade are you? No doubt this shade will change with the ebb and flow of life and depend on where you're living, your age, who you live with, how many animals, what type of work you do, and all those other things that influence the way our life rolls. Regardless of the shade, I salute you for your gallant contribution. I don't need a fridge edit, but I most certainly need a garden shed and seed storage edit. But before I dash into this gorgeous autumn day to do exactly that, I'm going to invite you to join me again next week when we chat with a future steading regular, if three conversations can be considered regular, the one and only pink locked legend, there could only be one of those, Hannah Maloney, who released a new book late last year, and we chatted in between her crazy book tour about creating huddles in her world. Till then, go gently and enjoy this turning. It is my absolute very favourite time of the year. If this conversation has struck a chord or rung a bell or any of those other beautiful sayings that people say with you, and you would like to support the show, then the link to the Buy Me a Coffee link is in the show notes. And if you think you'd like to support the bigger effort that Future Steading is contributing in content creation, you can also become a Patreon subscriber, and that link is also in the show notes. A massive shout out to Haddo and to Jenny, who both jumped on board this week, one with coffees, well, in my case, tea, and one as a monthly subscriber. Thanks so much, guys. It makes all the difference. Have a great week.